Marty Moscowen, welcome to Radio Times. On Monday, President Obama unveiled his $3.8 trillion proposed budget for the new fiscal year that starts on October 1st. It's a mix of spending cuts, spending increases, and higher taxes on the wealthy. Predictably, the Republicans were not impressed. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said it was a campaign document, not a real budget. We're going to examine the proposed taxes on the rich and dissect the Pentagon budget, but first we want to take a look at some of the politics of the budgeting process. And we asked Carrie Budoff-Brown to join us once again. She's a reporter for Politico, where she writes about the White House. And Carrie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Let me quote you. You wrote earlier this week, in fact, yesterday, the introduction of his spending blueprint showed both the practicalities of creating a budget in an election year and the narrow political space that Obama occupies. How narrow is that space?
I mean, it's a narrow space in that whatever he does with this budget, it's going nowhere in terms of Congress. So practically speaking, this is a budget that's dead on arrival in Congress. You have the majority leader saying in the Senate that they're not going to put forward a budget this year. So this would continue this pattern under this administration of not having budgets that are actually enacted. So in light of that, he has this opportunity to use this budget to press these messages that he's been pushing for the last 6 months since he turned away from deficit reduction, a hard focus on jobs, raising taxes on the wealthy, shared responsibility. This budget is just a continuation of what he's been talking about politically for many months.
So it is a political document in many ways because he's being blocked by Congress.
I mean, and that shouldn't necessarily surprise either Republicans who acted like they're outraged or, administration officials who take issue with reporters such as myself characterizing it as that. If this was a something that a budget is a chance to set out your priorities, so obviously you're not going to put out something that would sail through a Republican controlled House. This is a negotiating process, but this is very much an opportunity, just like his State of the Union was, his State of the Union address a few weeks ago, to set down the themes for this campaign year, for his reelection. Of course, in an ideal world, he would love to see these things enacted, but the White House is not naive, and they realize what they're up against.
You're down in Washington. Help us, though, understand. My understanding is that Congress has not passed a budget in about 1,000 days. Is that correct?
Yes, it is correct.
And so how are we running our government if they don't pass a budget or they haven't passed a budget in so many days?
In stopgap funding measures. So there's not a budget. A budget is just Congress takes what the president proposes to them, or they consider it, but they don't have to enact it. They actually go about writing their own budget, so it sets up a process within Congress that's very sort of tumultuous and divisive in and of itself. Congress, takes cues from the president, but they go about doing this themselves. So when we say there hasn't been a budget, a lot of the blame is turned to the president, but in fact it's Congress that is not, doing its work. There are appropriations bills that are actually that they're passed later in the year, right before deadlines to keep the government running. But in terms of an overall vision for the government, how it's going to spend its money, that has not happened for a few years, and that's problematic. Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, said something a few weeks ago that was difficult for the White House to defend. He said that not having a budget does create uncertainty for the economy, and he was critical of there not being a budget passed, and people are turning to the president and saying, well, why aren't you pushing this harder? The fact of the matter is that Congress is an institution in and of itself and has its own issues, and this is just something that Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, he just has not sort of forced this issue in recent years to force his caucus to push this out there, concerned in large part about the hard votes they would have to take. Republicans, Mitch McConnell, will of course try to force a vote on the Obama budget to embarrass the president, assuming that many Democrats will vote against it because there are tax increases in there, and in an election year that's difficult for Democrats even to vote for against their own, to vote for these tax cuts, even when it's their own president who's proposing it.
I have to say that was a very concise description of this very convoluted, complicated political process and system that we have.
Yes. It's not. It doesn't make much sense.
No,
right?
It doesn't. That makes no sense whatsoever.
Yes, but you know that's Washington. That's why they have a 10% approval rating right now. It's in the dumps, and this is just one more example of why that's the case, probably.
But going back to the president's proposal, it does seem that he has decided that the job creation is more important, at least today, than trying to figure out how to reduce the deficit.
Yeah, I mean, there was a striking statement by the White House Chief of Staff, Jack Lew, on Sunday on the talk show saying that this is not a time for austerity. Striking in that this was not what the White House was saying 9 months ago when they made a decision to engage very heavily with the House Speaker, the Republican House Speaker, on a deficit reduction plan, of course, forced by, a debt limit deadline that, really forced them into this. But, they really realized in, the last 6 months that this is not a winning issue for them, but even so, it's from a policy standpoint, they went a little bit too far in that direction. They're looking around at Europe, Britain, other places that have instituted strong austerity measures and have come to regret it. That's what administration aides were telling us on Monday. They actually cited Europe, Britain, saying, we have to look at those as lessons, and we have to balance it. Of course, they're saying they're trying to balance it. Republicans would disagree that this budget really represents true deficit reduction, but they are, going back in the other direction, the White House, from where they were 9 months ago, saying, now is the time for job creation, for stimulus measures. Of course, they're not saying the word stimulus. That's a dirty word here in Washington.
Is there a word they have substituted for that, or they just...
They just prefer saying job creation measures. It's the same thing as what they described as stimulus 3 years ago. But, yeah.
Stimulus is a bad word. But just picking up on what you said about Britain, what they're saying is looking at Britain, which has instituted some of these austerity measures, they've seen their unemployment rate go up.
Yes. And just, they saw what happened in the United States when there was months and months of talk about cutting government spending, threats of the debt limit being exceeded, and at the same time, the unemployment rate wasn't getting better. His poll numbers were getting worse. And, they're just putting this all together, looking at the lessons of other countries that have tried to institute this. And as you cut more, the chances for growth decline. It's sort of a circular process. So, they're just continuing this shift, this hard shift they made. And then this budget shows that I think they're even going further than they were in terms of being committed to that course than I think, than we would have expected a couple months ago.
And that's Carrie Budoff-Brown. She's a reporter for Politico, writes about the White House. The first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. We're taking a look at President Obama's budget proposal for the new fiscal year. Any questions or comments? Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Carrie, I'm curious whether you think the Republicans are chastened in any way. There seems to be support for this payroll, extending the payroll tax cut, the extension of jobless benefits, without this, the kind of demand for spending cuts that we saw in the past. Is there some significant change going on, do you think?
I mean, I think it's an incredible change for the Republican Party, given where they were and have been for almost the full duration of the Obama administration. But with the payroll tax cut in particular, insisting that it be paid for. This is a change from what they've traditionally said about tax cuts in general, that this is the people's money. It should be returned to them. Therefore, it does not need to be paid for. That was the rationale with the Bush tax cuts. Of course, in the last year, that has changed, and they said they have to pay for the payroll tax cut. That was the sticking point in December as to why they couldn't do a year-long extension, Republicans and Democrats. They had to do a two-month extension because they couldn't find ways to pay for it. Now, Chasen, yes. I mean, this is, and they fully acknowledge this, that their shift on this is that they don't want to give the president two more weeks of hammering away at them like they did, like he did back in December. It was very damaging to them politically. They don't want to give the president this issue to the extent that they are now, you know, clearly shifting positions on something that, you know, they really, you know, laid down, pretty strongly over the last year. So this is a very, you know, it's a very insidery Washington kind of thing, but it's a very significant shift. And there's concerns even in being expressed by Republicans that this really could undercut their message, very strong message they've had against the president with the deficit, adding to the deficit. Well, you know, concern that this is going to make it much harder for them to have that credibility with voters. And it could be, we may not see it right now. They may, politically, they looks like they're going to pass this by Friday, but in the long term, this could be damaging for the Republican brand, the House Republican brand, given that they came in there promising to do something much different.
Well, let me ask you about the Democrats, because they have, over the last couple of years, expressed some frustration with the White House. When you look at this budget, are there some carrots for the Democrats in there? And, of course, the president being a Democrat, I'm assuming that there is. But how do you see it, Carrie?
Sure. I mean, Democrats, until the president shifted to jobs back in September, he had a lot of tense relationships with Democrats on the Hill. They were very frustrated with him for pursuing that grand bargain with the speaker on deficit reduction. Since he changed to the strong jobs message back in September, they have come to really like him again.
Really?
Really? Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of funny that you would think, you know, they're the same party, they should all support it, but the Democrats are Democrats, and it's hard. You know, there's a lot of internal rifts, of course. But since September, his issues have not been, you know, with the Democratic leadership on the Hill, which he's had a strained relationship with for much of his administration for various reasons. They really like how he's talking about jobs. And so with this budget, I mean, he's singing off the same, you know, playlist as the Democrats on the Hill. Since this budget doesn't have much that's sort of new, or he's not shifting directions, there was not much here for Democrats to criticize. Most in the Democratic Party, there are moderates, of course, who are concerned about raising taxes, even on those who make above $250,000. He's sticking by that threshold. There are Democrats on the Hill who would like to see him not hit taxpayers who make above $250,000, raise that up to $1 million. They think that's more of a winning argument politically. So there's still some tension there, but by and large, I mean, this is a continuation of what he's been talking about. They're happy with this. You know, there's stuff in there for, you know, construction workers, just transportation funds, some stuff to prevent teacher layoffs, continuing the message of, you know, ending corporate subsidies, there's the youth programs. I mean, there's just a lot in there for them to like.
Well, Carrie, they're playing my song. We have to end our conversation. Thank you once again for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure, Marty. Thank you.
You're welcome. Carrie Budoff-Brown, reporter for Politico, where she writes about the White House. Mark Thompson from Time Magazine, waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about defense spending. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Bryn Mawr College Performing Arts Series welcomes the famed John Jespers Company for a one-week residency culminating in the world premiere of Fort Blossom Revisited, 2000-2012. A reworking of Jespers' legendary Fort Blossom, it's a personal look at the body and how we experience it, both as owners and spectators. Open to the public in the Hepburn Teaching Theater in Goodhart Hall, Friday, February 24th through Sunday the 26th, 610-526-5210 or brynmawr.edu/arts.
This is WHYY's President Bill Morazzo with a big thank you. Thank you to the more than 8,000 of you who made the choice to support our winter membership campaign. Your generosity not only produced $800,000 that can now be used to deepen your public media experience, but stands as a ringing endorsement to this unique brand of trusted news and information. If you haven't had the chance to express your membership support, I invite you to do so by visiting whyy.org. Thank you.
Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies supports WHYY and offers adult students the chance to earn an Ivy League bachelor's degree studying full-time or part-time and in the day or evening. Penn LPS welcomes transfer students and those just beginning their studies. Priority application deadline to receive financial aid packaging is March 15th. Details available online by searching Penn LPS. Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Pentagon spending is one of the big ticket items in the federal budget. While President Obama proposed military budget cuts of billions for the next fiscal year, he still calls for $614 billion in military spending. We've asked Time Magazine's Mark Thompson to join us once again. He's Washington Deputy Bureau Chief, four-time, also editor of its Battleland blog. And Mark Thompson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Sure thing, Marty.
You wrote recently in your Battleland blog that looking at the White House blueprint for the military reflects a decidedly conservative mindset. Translate that for us.
Well, basically, the United States, since the end of the Cold War, its military basically has shrunk, but it really hasn't changed direction. In other words, it's like, you know, someone living in a house with a one-acre lot. They want to keep the 1 acre. They want to keep the cars in the driveway running. They want to continue to trim the shrubbery and do all the stuff to keep the house in good shape. They've decided not to move to a smaller house, not to move to a condo, not to move to a different kind of place to see if there might be a different, more effective way in the 21st century to handle national security. And Barack Obama so far is continuing on that path.
Because it's politically fraught to do that?
Well, plainly, it's always easier for a Republican to make big changes in national security matters, especially where money is concerned, than a Democrat. But you talk to folks at the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill, you get an impression that, you know, basically not only did President Obama continue a lot of the anti-terror measures of former President George W. Bush, but he's also basically continuing the same outline on the military side of the national security ledger as well.
Let me ask you a very basic question, and you know more about defense budgeting certainly than I do, but essentially the Iraq war is over. Doesn't that free up billions and billions and billions of dollars?
Well, it's, of course, never that simple, Marty. We never pay for wars in our defense budget. They're sort of an add-on supplemental. So the first thing to realize is, yes, the size of the supplemental has shrunk dramatically. It's going to go down to about $88 billion next year, largely for Afghanistan. But then there is the so-called base budget. And the base budget next year is projected to be about $525 billion. You add those two numbers together, you come up with that roughly $614 billion you had mentioned earlier. A lot of war spending, so-called war spending, actually doesn't go for wars. It actually goes for weapons and aircraft that the military will tell you is being worn out more quickly because we are waging war. But in reality, the cuts, by and large, that the president has proposed going forward aren't really so much cuts in spending as Joe and Jane understand them, but rather they are a reduction in the rate of growth. So last year, the Pentagon wanted a lot more money in 2013 than it is now asking for. And they like to call that a cut, but normal people would not call that a cut.
I actually understand what you just said there, as complicated as that is. But it looks as if there are calls for cutting at least ground troops, military ground troops.
Well, sure there are. We are out of Iraq. We're coming out of Afghanistan. Those were two ground wars, by and large. And indeed, over the next 5 years, between 80 and 100,000 troops are slated to be mustered out. But the key thing to realize is this will still leave us with a bigger Army and a bigger Marine Corps than we had on 9/11. So we're not even going back to the pre-9/11 level. We will still have a robust Army and a top-notch Marine Corps. They're not being, you know, slashed to the levels they were in the 1990s. Now, that may change, but that's the current plan.
And the idea of continued investment, if I can say that, in weapon systems, in jets, fighter jets, things like that?
Well, plainly, procurement is being cut. If you look back over the last decade, U.S. troops, personnel costs have gone through the roof, both for the health care component, the retirement component, and the compensation component. I mean, soldiers are pretty well paid. I know that's unpopular to say, but if you compare a soldier with a civilian, and they have the same amount of education and experience, although they're not completely equivalent or translatable, and the soldier plainly has to go anywhere on a moment's notice, but he or she is paid better than 80% of his or her civilian counterparts. When the Pentagon recommends to the Congress, let's increase our pay to our soldiers next year by X for the last 10 years, right. Congress has boosted the X by at least one half of a percentage point. So the personnel costs are really tough to cut. But then again, so are the procurement costs, because many of the weapons are built all over the country in various lawmakers' districts. However, when push comes to shove, it's easier to cut hardware than it is to cut software, i.e. people. And that's why, even though the investment accounts account for roughly 20%, one-fifth of military spending, that being procurement and R&D, they are slated to receive about 40% of the cuts, including those bizarro cuts we talked about earlier. They're not cuts, but they're reductions in the projected rate of growth.
And I'm imagining a member of Congress who has one of those centers in their district. I mean, I can't imagine even a Republican or a Democrat in any way lobbying for a closure of a manufacturing plant.
Oh, plainly not. I mean, obviously, given the economic downturn, these jobs, number one, pay well. Number two, are pretty steady, so long as the weapons production continues. And number three, you know, they're needed. There needs to be some stream of new weapons coming on and new testing of technologies to find better ways to do it. But the fact of the matter is that even if next January sequestration happens, and that's the congressionally mandated additional cuts of $1.2 trillion because the super committee could not make up its mind on how to do it last November, our defense budget in 2013 would be peeled back to the level of our defense budget in 2007. And so when you hear lawmakers screaming and howling about the deep cuts and the disarming of America and the slashing and the burning and the laying off of troops, well, the budget would go back to the 2007 level in the worst case. And I know lots of Americans who would be very happy living at their 2007 level of salary.
Interesting. But what is the chance that $1.2 trillion will be slashed from the military budget in, what, a year's time?
Well, it would only half of that would be for the military.
Okay.
The other half would be allocated elsewhere. But you talk to experts both inside the Pentagon and outside the Pentagon, they say the following. They say, listen, that super committee last fall had the best chance to come up with those numbers and force an up or down vote in both houses of Congress. Now that that moment has passed, we're going to have to go through the regular congressional process to try to figure a way around that. So you got a couple of things going on here. Number one, Congress, of course, could always change the law. They could simply modify the law to say, forget it, the deadline is not going to be next January of 2013. Or Congress could allocate the $1.2 trillion in savings necessary for the coming decade and make those happen. That was the super committee's challenge. And parcel them out in a smart way. The concern at the Pentagon is that the sequestration process is, some people call it a meat axe, some people call it a guillotine, but it's very much of a haircut across the board, so there can be no priority set. All of the accounts, with one or two exceptions, have to go equally deep on everything from boots to bullets to tanks, and that's not a very smart way when you're dealing with a declining budget to allocate your resources.
And that's Mark Thompson. He's a Times Washington Deputy Bureau Chief, also editor of its Battleland blog. And we are talking about President Obama's proposed budget unveiled earlier this week and its potential impact on military spending and military cuts. A couple of open lines at 1-888-477-2976. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions or comments about military spending, please do give us a call. Mark, even going back to, as you mentioned, military pay better than civilian pay when you compare and contrast an employee, thinking about those retirement benefits, veterans benefits, and even the fact that, and I want to check with you to see if this is still true, that you can retire after 20 years in the military. Is that true?
Right.
So you
with
so
half
you,
your basic pay.
With half your basic pay. So you could be in your 40s and, in a sense, retired on half your basic pay.
You could be 38, as many enlisted folks are. But a couple of things about that, Marty. Number one, most folks who join the military never retire. They get out well before they become eligible for retirement. So what does that mean? That means that, you know, unlike in the civilian world, where you can start kicking money into a 401k or a IRA as soon as you begin working, if you belong in the military and you don't stay for 20 years, you get zilch, zero, if you don't go for the full 20. So there's talk now underway that, you know, gee, is that the right way to do it? Because does having that 20-year mark encourage deadwood to hang around? Simply because, you know, once you're there for 10, 12, 14 years, that 20 starts looking closer and closer, and gee whiz, you know, you really want to make it. So they're now discussing, and some surveys are being done, because this hasn't been done, to figure out. Military compensation is so complicated. And what is the best thing? Is it, would you rather have government-funded health care or an extra $3,000 in your pocket each year? And because it's split into so many pots, you know, many soldiers and sailors can't figure it out. And so what the government is trying to do, and what some outside groups are trying to do, is get a better sense of the entire compensation package and figure out what the troops really want. Because, let's face it, we've seen this over the decades. When the economy is bad, military recruiting is good. Now, there's some, you know, some green shoots in the economy now. If over the next 5 years the economy starts rip-roaring, as some people suggest it might, military recruiting is going to, you know, really be in a hammerlock. It's really going to hurt. The last time that happened, the military was spending more than $1 billion a year in incentives to get folks to come in. Mm-hmm. They were lowering standards. They were granting an increasing number of moral and criminal waivers to incoming troops. So that's a perpetual seesaw, and you got to keep in mind that the national economy really drives the recruiting picture.
Let me get some callers in. It looks like we have Greg from Doylestown joining us on Radio Times. Greg, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. Yes, good morning. I disagree with one of the fundamental statements that Mark made originally, that we haven't changed the posture of the military fundamentally from the Cold War environment and thereof.
And can you expand on that, Greg?
Certainly.
Oh, I think we, unfortunately, I think we have a very bad phone line, but I think I know what he's saying, Mark Thompson. Thinking about drone strikes, also the use of special forces, elite forces that we have certainly seen in the last year, does that signal a change in the military philosophy and approach?
Well, sure it does, at one end of the spectrum. But drone strikes and special forces are less than 10% of our military. I mean, the key thing is, we still have a nuclear triad consisting of hundreds of nuclear weapons up top, bombers, land-based ICBMs, and Navy submarines. That is a Cold War artifact that we can't seem to get rid of. We still have, you know, tens of thousands of troops in Germany, a country doing very well now, in Korea, in Japan. The United States now has its citizens pay a heck of a lot more per capita than any of our other allies, usually twice as much. Now, in terms of tweaking the military to more reflect the change in today's world, yes, plainly, when your foes stop massing tanked armies and instead are individuals with box cutters, that's going to change in some way the forward edge of the battle area, sort of the front line of most kinds of wars. But plainly, there is still a Cold War heritage in the military. You see it in the F-35 program, the Pentagon's biggest program, the biggest weapons program in history, $380 billion to buy three variants of aircraft for the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marines. These are very short-legged aircraft. They require a man or a woman in the cockpit. They can't fly very far. And you sort of have to wonder, why are we spending $380 billion on this category of airplane when, as Greg noted, you know, drones are becoming such a bigger part of our arsenal? And so I think that's a fair question and one that really hasn't been addressed yet.
Greg, thanks for calling in. Sorry we couldn't complete your phone call there. Let me see what Mike from Philadelphia has to say. Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
My name's Mike, Philadelphia. I'm actually an Air Force captain who was just reduced in force in anticipation of the upcoming budget cuts. But I did want to make one comment with regard to something that your guest said earlier. He said that soldiers and sailors and airmen are paid better than their civilian counterparts. I think the point needs to be made that a lot of the compensation they receive is soft in terms of health benefits, life insurance, food or room and board, as it were. The actual money that goes into their pockets really is minimal and quite sad compared to civilians with the same kind of education and training.
Well, Mike, I appreciate the phone call. And, Mark, anything you want to say in response?
No, I think Mike is absolutely right. I don't know if he were in the group of the whatever it was, nearly 200 Air Force pilots who had almost gotten to the 20-year mark and were forced out. I've interviewed several of those folks and actually wrote about them. And a lot of people felt that they were handled rather poorly by the Air Force hierarchy. But to be sure, number one, not to denigrate the military or its paycheck in any way, but it is, a lot of it is not in cash. A lot of it is in other forms of compensation, everything from retirement to health care, that many other Americans don't get anymore. And they are, come on, let's face it, they are called upon to do life-threatening missions on a daily basis, which is something most of us in the civilian world don't have to have. So we do need to factor that into the equation.
Well, Mark Thompson, as always, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Times, Mark Thompson joining us. And we've got another guest waiting in the wings. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Cayley Group, presenting How the West of Ireland Helped to Save Illan Bagpiping, an informative talk by Dr. Scott B. Spencer, featuring Ivan Goff. The lecture takes place on Saturday, February 18th at 3:30 p.m., followed by an evening concert with Ivan Goff and Eamon O'Leary at 8. Both lecture and concert take place at the Commodore Barry Club. Tickets at PhiladelphiaCayleyGroup.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Writer James Fallows takes stock of President Obama in this election year and asks, is he chess master or pawn? Also, you've heard of flash mobs. Now some communities are embracing cash mobs, sending crowds with cash to small businesses. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Westtown School supports WHYY. Since 1799, Westtown has invited students pre-K through grade 12 to pursue a life-size education, one that helps to prepare each student for what comes next, not only for college and career, but for a whole life. You can learn more by attending Westtown's open house on Monday, February 20th at 8:30 a.m. Details at westtown.edu. Westtown School, a life-size education.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. President Obama has been signaling for several months now that it's time for the wealthy to pay more taxes. His new budget proposal outlined on Monday underscores that message. We've asked John McKinnon to join us, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. He writes for the Wall Street Journal. And John McKinnon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Any surprise when you saw the president's proposal for the new fiscal year that he wants to increase taxes for the better off in this country?
Well, you're right. That in itself was not a surprise. He's been signaling that for a while. And, in fact, throughout his term in office, he's been proposing higher taxes on higher income people. But think there was a surprise just in the extent of the increases here. Excuse me. The you know, the total is around $1.4 trillion in tax increases for higher-income people over the next decade. And they've never really presented it that way, and it's a pretty surprising number, really. I mean, it's a big number.
How does the administration then define the well-off in this country?
Well, they have two ways of doing that. There's $250,000 floor, and then there's another floor at $1 million, and they have increases for people over $250,000, and they have more increases for people over $1 million.
And when people talk about that money, that's net, right? It's after your so-called expenses and deductions?
Well, yeah, there are different ways to define it, but the administration is definitely looking at that as the amount that you would be earning after basically some of your deductions. It
right.
gets a little complicated.
It does.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking about our tax system, which is full of complications. And I guess looking at this, these people making more than $250,000, the idea is to what? End the Bush tax cuts for them?
Yeah, they would face the end of the Bush era tax rates. There would also be a few more limitations, well, a lot more limitations on the deductions that they can take. And that one's kind of sneaky. The administration's been proposing that all along, and it would essentially reduce the value of their deductions for, like, their home interest or, their
charitable.
Healthcare or charitable, exactly. And this limit has been expanded significantly in this budget so that it really takes quite a bite out of folks over $250,000. I don't think that's gotten a lot of attention. And then... there are lots of increases like that for folks over 250.
Well, just a couple of follow-up questions here. Then, if this comes to pass, then those people would be paying 39.5%. It goes back to the way it was under President Clinton.
Yeah, that's right. The top rates would be as they were in the Clinton administration.
And in terms of deductions, would they lose those deductions for a mortgage or charitable or health care, or they don't get as much of a tax break on them?
Yeah, it's this is a hard thing to get your head around,
yeah.
But basically, when you get a deduction, let's say you get a $100 deduction, if you're in the 35% bracket, which is what the top rate is now, then the value of that deduction to you is $35. So what the administration's saying is it's wrong for someone in the highest income bracket to get more value out of a given deduction than someone in a lower tax bracket would get. So what they're saying is, let's limit the value of that $100 deduction to 28%, or in other words, $28.
Right. And the idea that, and just to make sure we all understand this, because I'm getting some quizzical looks from our studio here, and it's okay, but because we have a progressive tax system, so that if I pay, instead of 35%, 28% of that $100, I only get a $28 deduction. So I essentially get a less deduction. The idea is to somehow equalize that?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right.
And is that true for health care? People get to deduct that if they get it through their employer? Charitable deductions as well, the same kind of formula, the same kind of thinking?
Health care is a little bit of a separate animal. Basically, the tax system just ignores the health care that you get from your employer, at least right now.
Right.
Under the Health Care Act that passed a couple of years ago, that gradually begins to change. But essentially, the tax system, this is kind of unique, but the tax system just ignores it. It's called an exclusion, and you just never you never have to deal with it from a tax standpoint.
And that's John McKinnon. He writes for the Wall Street Journal, and we are talking about the Obama administration's or President Obama's budget proposal, which was presented on Monday. And it does call for taxes on the more well-off in this country. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. John, does this proposal do anything or look at the estate tax?
Yes, the administration, excuse me, has been concerned about the estate tax for a long time, and they've had a proposal to increase the estate tax each year. essentially their proposal right now would be to return to the rate that was in effect in 2009, mm-hmm. which is 45% with a $3.5 million exclusion. And it, currently the rate is a little lower than that. Republicans, remember back in December of 2010, brokered a deal with the administration that got the estate tax lower than that. The rate right now is 35%. The administration wants it to go to 45%.
What about tax increases or looking at the tax rate for people who make money from dividends? And, of course, you know, this got a lot of attention when Mitt Romney unveiled his tax returns, and people saw that he made less than 15 or actually had paid less than 15% tax rate. Does the Obama administration look at this?
Oh, definitely. That is that was a big feature of this budget. And one of the surprises really was that the administration is now proposing to tax dividends at basically ordinary income rates, in other words, up to 39.6% in their proposal. And, you know, since the Bush administration tax cuts of 2003 took effect, the top rate for dividends has been 15%, mm-hmm. and that's the same as the top rate for capital gains. It, essentially, all investment income is now taxed at a top rate of 15%, which has been a tremendous boon for very, very wealthy people like Mitt Romney. And you can see that in the tax returns that he's released. His effective rate has been at around 15%, and that's basically just because of the relatively low rates that are imposed now on investment income.
Do you think the Obama administration then is trying to treat income, in a sense, equally, saying that if you make money from a salary or make money from the stock market, it should be treated the same way?
I think that's one of their arguments. That's not an argument that they pushed really hard on Monday when they released the budget and all these details. They basically say they said two things on Monday. One, you know, we need the money. And we have to get this deficit down somewhat. The other thing they were saying was, it's okay to treat dividends differently from capital gains. In other words, tax them more than capital gains, because capital gains are basically long-term investments, and just by their nature, there's more risk in a long-term investment. Dividends are a very sort of short-term investment, because companies typically pay them a quarterly basis or something like that. So dividends don't deserve such a low rate. But there, you can also look at this as the beginning of a process of raising taxes on investment income. I mean, there are basically two schools of thought here. One is sort of the Obama administration's view, which is that it's basically not fair to tax working people at effectively a higher rate then you tax the income that's earned basically by rich people through no particular effort of their own in some cases, and people who are, clipping coupons, as they say, arguably don't deserve a lower tax rate than somebody who gets up and goes to work every morning. So,
the other
school of thought is, if you've got an economy that depends so much on capital investment, then you should really encourage capital investment, and that means lower taxes.
Let me get, looks like Robert from Haddonfield to join our conversation. And Robert, go ahead, you're on the air.
Sure, hi. I just wanted to, I'm not totally clear on the differentiation between the tax rate on dividends versus the 15% tax rate that Mitt Romney pays, that Warren Buffett pays. From my understanding, it seems as though that the tax rate on dividends represents a very small chunk of what people are talking about as like investment income or something that we need to address in order to actually raise revenue. So this kind of seems to me like almost a political move as opposed to a real cost-saving or revenue-raising measure.
Robert, thanks for calling. That's kind of a follow-up to what we were talking about, John. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I think that you raise a valid point. This is certainly going to have a political component to it, I think. The administration's approach on taxing investment income definitely allows them to highlight, the tax rate, the effective tax rate that Mitt Romney is paying, that lots of wealthy people, very wealthy people, are paying right now. And, you know, that's a good political argument for them, especially when they're trying to motivate their base and just, you know, stay focused on the offense.
Well, and just to underscore that, the median household income in this country is something like $50,000, just to, you know, put our conversation into some kind of context.
That's right. The median income is around, median household is around $50,000, and those folks basically pay, you know, an effective rate that's around the rate that Mitt Romney pays. And, you know, I think that it's a fair question to ask. Is that reasonable? Is that the right approach to have? On the other hand, I would say that this proposal that the administration is making on dividends does also raise a lot of money. It raises about $200 billion over the next decade, and that's a significant chunk of the $1.4 trillion that they're proposing for higher-income people. So there's real money here.
Sure. Robert, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Talking with John McKinnon. He writes for the Wall Street Journal. We're talking about the Obama administration's proposed tax increases on the rich, on the well-off in this country. And John, let me talk a little bit about this Buffett rule. And this is for people that are, I guess, making more than or over $1 million. How does that pan out, or what would that entail?
We didn't learn a whole lot more about their Buffett rule from this budget. But here's what we know so far. The administration, this is a long-term proposal. It's kind of an idea that they're just putting out there. It's not really, you know, part of their budget math, if you will. They're not relying on this proposal to raise money for next year's budget. But they're saying if we do a big tax reform in the next few years, we would like to see a rule in effect that would say that people who make $1 million or more should pay basically at least as much as, you know, ordinary middle-class folks. And they have said that means that there should be at least a 30% tax rate on folks over $1 million. It's like effectively a minimum tax.
So the idea is that
But we don't really know what it's going to look like in effect, and it could just be a principle that they want to apply and not a separate you know, set of rules. It could just be a principle that they want to apply to tax reform overall, so that you couldn't isolate how much money the Buffett rule would raise versus other provisions in the tax code, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Well, and let's get even deeper into the weeds here, because there's talk about replacing the alternative minimum tax, which, as you have written, you know, goes back to the 1960s, but now it's, and the idea was to, I guess, capture some of the money from wealthy people, but now it has impacted the middle class.
Yeah, the AMT... if you're not familiar with the AMT, you really don't want to know, because it's kind of a tax nightmare. It's sort of a monster that's devouring the regular tax. And what it does is impose a minimum tax on people who have too many deductions and credits. So once you cross the line and you've reduced your taxable income too much with deductions and credits, then the alternative minimum tax kicks in and pushes your tax higher. And as you say, originally it was designed to affect only the very wealthy, and now it's basically reaching down well into the middle class and, you know, even people with $50,000 in total income. And so every year Congress has to pass a law that says, you know, people over X amount or people under X amount won't be affected by the AMT, and it's gotten to be an extremely expensive thing for Congress to do every year, because, you know, the AMT basically would, if it were in effect, it would be raising more money than the regular tax.
Well, that's interesting. Do you think there's appetite for real tax reform? I mean, we've been talking about, you know, changing rates and deductions, you know, within the current tax system. But do you think there's really an appetite for actual reforming of the system?
I do think there's a lot of appetite for that, especially out in the real world where people have to confront the mind-boggling complexities and ambiguities of the current system. I mean, it's been changed so often and patched so often and tinkered with so often that it's basically just almost impossible for anyone to understand it, really. And so I think there is a lot of appetite out in the real world. The problem is, in Washington, it's just very, very, very hard to get something done in terms of fundamental tax reform. So I got to say, I'm skeptical that it's going to happen anytime soon.
And we only have 30 seconds here, and that's just because people are able to lobby in order to get the kinds of tax deals that benefit them?
That's right. I mean, there are so many entrenched interests that are reflected in the tax code. I mean, the tax code is how the government reaches out and touches people, and it really, really matters to people. And so everyone's got a special provision that they like and want to preserve, and it just means that for every line in the tax code, there's a constituency, and so it's very hard to make fundamental changes in it.
Well, John McKinnon, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Oh, you're welcome.
And he writes for the Wall Street Journal. Mark Thompson from Time Magazine also joined us during this hour. And we started things off with Politico's Carrie Budoff-Brown. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.